I'm Lee Hatcher with the Human Condition podcast and our arresting title, Parenting for New Parents, Screwing Up in Your Own Particular Way. I'm in conversation with Christina O'Connell, a clinical psychologist at the Resilience Centre. Now, Christina approaches this issue from two important perspectives. First, for years, she's had a special interest in parenting children and their parents. But second, she's had to put all the theory into practice with her own little bundle of joy. And there she's learned a thing or two. That's new. We begin with a brief fly-through the Christina O'Connell story.
I was born in Hong Kong. I grew up in Southeast Asia. And I went to international schools and I had teachers from all over the world. And that's why my accent's all kind of funky. My dad's from Switzerland and still has a very Swiss accent, which my friends find quite hilarious. And my mum's from the UK, but I came to Australia in 2000 and did all my university training here in Australia. And now I'm married to an Australian man from Wagga. So couldn't get more Australian than that.
What an eclectic life. Why clinical psychology, Christina?
Up until I was the age 16, I wanted to be a medical doctor because growing up in Asia, I saw a lot of poverty and I thought it was unfair that I happened to be born to parents who could provide and some people weren't born to parents who could provide. And so I wanted to be a doctor to go back to Asia to take care of people who couldn't afford medical care. But when I was 16, I realized that I don't like needles, I don't like sick people, and I don't like blood. So that didn't work. And then I spoke to my mum about it, and my mum, being as incredible as she is, said, "What about being a doctor of the mind and helping people who struggle with not physical problems, but others?" And that clicked.
And it's something that you've gone on to that has really floated your boat. What's the big attraction about clinical psychology, especially when it comes to parenting?
I like working with young people, especially children, because of neuroplasticity, which is just a fancy word for them being able to adjust their thinking easily. It means that working with young people, you can see these shifts and these changes, and that's quite incredible. And I like working with parents because they always have the right intentions, even if it doesn't always translate.
So after years of being an expert in parenting and talking about it endlessly, you became a parent last year.
Yes, big surprise.
Well done.
Thank you.
Now tell me about this perfect child.
Sebastian indeed is perfect.
And his mum?
Yeah, I'm still working on me.
So because you've been such an expert, read so much, must have been easy.
You would think so.
I'm joking.
Look, for me, I was thinking, I've got all of this information in my head. Surely there's this pressure to be perfect or to do everything right. And having too much in your head can be problematic. And I was mindful that I'm a perfect candidate for postnatal depression, because all of the research shows that if you have a lot of knowledge, you can challenge yourself to the point where you actually realize that you're making the mistake while you're making it. And I like to be in charge of the situation, which doesn't work with a newborn.
No. So there were surprises.
Massive surprises.
What were they, Christina? For someone like you who is the expert at work.
Well, every child is different. Every baby behaves differently. And in all of my training in psychology, there was no training around what do you do when your baby is screaming in the middle of the night and you've done everything you're supposed to do and they're still screaming. What do you do then? No one teaches you that stuff. It's a challenge on your marriage and you have to really work as a team and make decisions together. It was funny, when I was talking to the midwife, she actually said to me, "Whatever you do, never read the book Save Our Sleep." And I said, "Why? It sounds pretty good." And she said, "Save Our Sleep will do nothing but increase your anxiety levels." She said, "Don't follow anything too prescriptive."
Was it because you can't save your sleep?
It's a fallacy.
Yes.
Well, no, actually, I was walking through a bookstore when I was maybe 6 or 7 months pregnant, and I picked up this book called French Children Don't Throw Food, And firstly, I thought the title was funny, so
yes.
I picked that up and I actually read that book, and it was so fascinating from a psychologist's perspective and also from an international perspective, because it was about this woman who, she's from the US and her husband is from the UK, and they raised a little girl in Paris. And so she would go back to mother's groups in the US and go back to mother's groups in the UK. And then she was raising her little girl in Paris. And she was noticing that all these different groups of mothers were raising their children slightly differently, like they had different parenting philosophies. And she writes this book with such comedy behind it and looks at the philosophies. And she then interviewed psychologists in France and pediatricians in France and psychologists and pediatricians in the Anglo-Saxon world as well, the US and the UK. And she found that there were actually quite significant contrasts. I mean, yes, there were golden threads in some aspects, but for the most part, there were contrasts in how they perceived raising a newborn baby.
Can you summarize the differences? Some of them? Some of the big ones.
The French, in the book anyway, and I'm no expert on the French philosophy, but just from reading the book, it seemed to me that the French did a lot of observing of their baby. So when their newborn, even 2-3 weeks old, was crying in their bed, the French would listen and watch and wait. And their biggest philosophy was called the pause. When they would pause, they would see that the baby was between sleep cycles and would sometimes whinge and even flutter their eyes. And then the baby would find its sleep again and go back to sleep. Whereas the Anglo-Saxon world, the mums tend to be driven a little bit by fear. Oh, my baby's awake, pick them up and put them on the boob or put them on the bottle or whatever they would do, because they were fearful that their baby had just woken. And the French would perceive that as, you've now interrupted the sleep cycle and taught your baby to wake up between sleep cycles. Mm-hmm. So this was one of the take-home messages when Sebastian was a newborn.
The message being what?
To pause.
Yeah.
And to watch and to wait and not to react straight away with my anxiety. And everyone knows that your anxiety is slightly higher when you haven't got enough sleep, when you're tired, yes, when you're hormonal. So the combination was a bit dangerous.
That's easy.
That's easy. But you know who's less hormonal?
Mm.
And less tired and hasn't just gone through childbirth?
The baby. Yes. Yeah.
But also my husband. Ah. So I trained him.
Ah.
I said, look, I'm going to want to pick up Sebastian. I'm going to want to go in there. Can you remind me about the pause when I forget?
That's genius.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Came up with it all on my own.
Yeah, no. But it doesn't say it's easy to do.
No,
I guess
not.
You're saying it's not easy.
It's not easy to do because all of your hormones and all of your maternal drives are telling you to pick up the baby that's crying. And what is interesting is people will say, oh, so you're suggesting cry it out. But that's not what I'm suggesting. And nor is it what they talked about in the book, French Children Don't Throw Food. If the baby is distressed and crying for a prolonged period, they're upset. You pick them up and maybe they need food. I mean, a 2-3-4-week-old baby typically needs food every 2 to 3 hours. But what they're saying is don't pick them up on the first whimper.
Okay.
You wait.
It's probably worth asking, how long is a pause?
The pause for me, and this doesn't, they're not, it's not specified in the book because it's not prescriptive. It's more a philosophy and a way of looking at things. But for me, as Sebastian got older, I would wait a little bit longer.
Minutes?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story.
When, tell me.
When Sebastian was first born, I'm not going to go into the labor story, but my goodness, it was exhausting. I remember the first couple of nights in the hospital, he would cry and he would whimper in the night. And I would grab his crib, which was just next to my bed, which was on wheels, and I would push it and I would rock it. And then I would say, it's okay, Sebastian, mummy's here, partially out of sheer exhaustion that I did not want to sit up.
Poor soul.
I was too tired. But also I had the book in the back of my head and I'm like, let's just see. It was like a test. It was an experiment. Yes, I did experiment with my own child. You have this on radio. And honestly, many of those times he would go straight back to sleep.
Wow.
And this was only a few days old. He would have been hungry. But if he was hungry, he was going to continue crying. And yes. When he continued crying, I fed him, of course.
Everyone's asking the question, what's the food thing in this miracle title?
Oh. I think it's a philosophy. People talk about French children being so well behaved and that you can take them out to restaurants and, you know, they sit still and they wait. And I think the idea is not necessarily about throwing food, but more...
Good.
I think it's more about developing a sense of self-control and knowing how to behave. And that's about not following just your impulses and getting what you want when you want it. But... knowing how to pause, and I guess mum pausing with a newborn is already setting the groundwork for delayed gratification later on in life.
You're listening to the Human Condition podcast. I'm in conversation with Christina O'Connell on parenting for new parents, screwing up in your own particular way. Now, continuing on that theme of delayed gratification, Christina explores some really interesting studies with some pretty compelling results.
I don't know how many people have heard of this incredibly large study done in Dunedin in the South Island of New Zealand. They did a longitudinal study starting in the early 1970s where they followed individuals, males and females, from all socioeconomic backgrounds. This study was one of the largest studies ever done, and it had a 95% retention rate. They were measuring so many different factors as an attempt to find what is the number one factor in a child or young person that can be predictive or highly correlating with successful outcomes in adulthood, specifically in their early 30s. And they looked at marriage and long-term marriages. They looked at career and educational attainments. They looked at jail time. They looked at drug use. They looked at alcohol use. They looked at mental health measures as well. And these were all the things that they took into account when measuring success, in inverted commas. They made so many predictions about what the number one predictor would be for successful outcomes. What would you guess it would be?
Maybe the quality of the parents.
Yeah.
How together they are.
So some people predicted that.
Mm.
Some people thought it had to do with socioeconomic background.
Yep.
Some people thought it had something to do with whether the parents remained married or whether they were separated.
Mm. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. The quality of that connection, the marriage.
Or the attachment.
Yep,
all of those questions. They actually found that the number one predictor is a child's ability for self-control.
Mm.
And how do you measure self-control?
Good question. The answer is...
because that's the... as parents, we're going to make 101,000 mistakes. It's just which combination of mistakes are we going to make? I mean...
I like experts like you. but of course, that's real. That's true.
It is true. We're all going to make our own variation. And you know what I find funny is it's also to do with generations. You know, in different points of history, they were telling parents different things. My mum tells me a story about her mother who told her, you should not breastfeed. It's not fashionable to breastfeed. You should bottle feed. And now they're pushing breastfeeding. So depending which generation, there are different rules for everything.
Yes.
Anyway, so if we're going to make all of these mistakes, then you want to get one thing right. But if there's only one thing that you're going to get right in parenting, let it be the number one predictor of successful outcomes in adulthood, which according to the largest longitudinal study in the world so far, is self-control.
Why is that? And how do we nurture a child who has self-control?
how they measured self-control is through the marshmallow experiment. So the marshmallow experiment was done at Stanford University, and it was done with 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds and a few other ages. But the Dunedin study said that you can predict it from the age of 3. So you have a 3-year-old in a room by themselves, and the experimenter gives them one marshmallow on a plate in front of them. And the experimenter says, if you wait here for 15 minutes, I will come back and you can have a second marshmallow. If, however, you eat the marshmallow before then, you will not get a second marshmallow.
This is torture.
This is torture.
For a poor child.
But they can do it.
Yeah, they can.
There are some children who have such a high level of self-control that they can wait 15 minutes. And this is a number one predictor of successful outcomes as an adult. So you want to teach a child that they can wait. So if you think about the French Children Don't Throw Food book, they have to wait. Mm. They have to pause. It's delayed gratification. And you think about a child in the car. I'm hungry, mommy. I want a snack. I'm hungry. I want a snack. If you give them that snack straight away, you're teaching instant gratification.
Yes.
You want to teach them the ability to have self-control. You can wait, darling. If I'm in the middle of an adult conversation and my little one comes running up to me and interrupts me, and I give in to that straight away, that's instant gratification. If I say, hang on a minute, darling, and then continue my adult conversation, then that child is learning to wait.
And the killer point is that it's not just for them, but it's for their adulthood as well.
Exactly. It has a flow-on effect.
Yeah. You surprised by that?
No, it's a skill. You think about it. It's like a muscle. There are parts of you that you need to practice and practice and practice before you can attain it. Of course, instant gratification is easier. But to have delayed gratification, to have self-control, to think about future consequences of your decision, that's an intellectual muscle almost. It's like challenging yourself. You need to push yourself to do that. So it makes sense.
In practical ways, in me as an adult, how am I going to be different from a child with no control? In practical terms, what kind of things are going to go on in my life?
With self-control.
Yeah.
So an adult with self-control won't eat the whole birthday cake, even though they probably want to. This is why I'm working on my own self-control at the moment.
How noble, how worthy.
Just one slice of cake, Christina. You can do it.
For 15 minutes.
But also, you know, there's instant gratification when you come home after a long day at work. There's instant gratification if you've put your child down to sleep and you can watch television, or you can have that really discipline of going, no, you know what, I should go for that walk, or I should go for that run. And then when I come back, that's when I can enjoy the show. It's delayed gratification for yourself as well.
Is there a way in which delayed gratification and self-control feeds itself? So in a way, the more self-controlled you are, the more self-controlled you will be, and the more successful you will be as an adult.
Yes, because you actually get the reward not in the moment, but in the long term. So there is the reward if you use self-control to eat well or to go for your walk in the evening. You get the rewards of feeling strong in your body and feeling healthy and having lots of energy. But it's long-term reward system, which is why it's so hard to develop if you haven't developed it as a child.
Mm. So to wrap up, a great guru who's had experience and expertise in this area, give me the top three things that new parents should keep in mind or that would help them in managing their situation and their children better.
In a world of instant gratification, our job as parents is not to be their friend. They have those. It's to be their parent. And sometimes that means that they won't like what we do. And part of what we need to really, really focus on is delaying gratification and making our children wait. Because there are so many elements through technology and the like that they are gratified instantly. And we need them to learn some self-control. And as parents, I think that is a big part of our role. That's the first thing. Delayed gratification. The second thing is that in this world, children more and more, the population is becoming more and more narcissistic. All you have to do is look at social media, but you also need to look at the statistics. There are more and more narcissists coming out at the moment, and the research is young in that area, which is why we don't know much about it. But the first thing that a child needs to learn is that they are not the center of the universe. The world does not revolve around them. We do not want to be raising these little narcissists. They need to start learning about people outside of themselves at a time that is developmentally appropriate. And I think that as the parent, we can often see where they're at, and we can follow them at where they're at and follow their lead on that. Now, that's the second thing. The third thing is self-care. Oh my gosh, so many parents sacrifice their own needs for the needs of their child. And I know that that sometimes sounds beautifully altruistic, doesn't it? And it sounds so Christian.
And of course, wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah, but the reality is, if you are self-sacrificing all the time, then you're never taking care of yourself. And if you're not taking care of yourself, you have nothing more to give. If a mother looks after her own self-care, if a father looks after his own self-care, and the two of them look after their marriage, the marriage is the foundation of the family. And that is what we need to put a lot of energy, a lot of time, and a lot of love into, because our children will blossom as a result of having that beautiful foundation where we take care of each other.
You hardly hear that said today.
No, it's sad. And that is the that is the basis of our society. And I think that's part of why we have such a lonely society, and part of why I will never be out of a job. So if we create that foundation where mom is looking after herself, dad is looking after himself, and the two of them have enough energy to then look after each other, the kids will be fine.
What wisdom, what practical wisdom, Christina O'Connell. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on the Human Condition Podcast. Great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Human Condition Podcast. I'm Lee Hatcher. There are so many great parenting resources on the Resilience Centre website, www.theresiliencecentre.com.au.